Welcome to a new location. Those who are watching on video are wondering why there's a choo-choo train behind me. Well, probably they weren't wondering that, but now that I pointed it out, they probably are wondering, what's that choo-choo train behind you? We're in a children's library, we're in the Levi Yitzchok Library. Because Baruch Hashem, things are so happening at Chabad of the Five Towns. So for the summer, we are relocated here to the library on Central Avenue. But we're going to continue with our regular learning, just with a slight venue change. Okay, and this all of this is meaningless to the people who watch on YouTube or listen on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts. They're like, I don't even know what you're talking about. Okay. Yes, you're in the right place. This is weekly text-based Tanya. And we are on chapter 22. Chof Beis. As we said when we started Perek Yud Ches, we're on a journey that takes many prokim. These are the most confusing prokim. Now, I've been misunderstood before, and someone said, Rabbi, you said these are the most confusing prokim. There are prokim that are more confusing. That's not what I said. I said not that the most confusing ideas are in these prokim, but that taken as a whole, it is very hard to keep track of the thread of ideas that's going from Yod Chas until Chof Hei. So there may be more difficult ideas in Tanya, but to keep track of the conversation from Yod Chas through Chof Hei, for that you need a good memory. So I just want to recap. Yud Ches, we started off and we said, we're going to get access to some high-powered love and awe of Hashem without having to generate it through meditation, which is the normal tried and true way, is you create emotions through meditation. That we know. And we haven't given up on that. We're using this as a temporary measure. And we said that this love is already installed in us because it's a Yerusha, it's an inheritance we get from the Aves. It's called an Ava Mesuteres, a latent love, which also implies that it's hidden, which it is, until it's triggered. How is it triggered? By intense circumstances, usually a test of faith, do or die, moment of truth. In Yud Tes, we spoke about the nature of the soul is not unlike the nature of a flame, which you know, Matzah Shabbos, we were lighting the Havdalah candle, and I was showing the kids how to get the Havdalah candle going. You just have to turn it upside down. And I explained to them, you know why? Because it's the nature of flame to want to rise aloft and rejoin its source underneath the lunar sphere. And they looked at me like, you're looking at me. But that's what it says in Tanya. And you don't have to know what that means. And I did it purposely. I said something purposely that I knew was cryptic. Because he says right there in that chapter that's what Teva means. Teva is nature. Nature is any phenomenon that we know it occurs, we just don't know why it occurs. Like, we could describe the mechanics, we could describe how it happens, but ultimately, why is it that way? That's the way that it is. So the nature of the flame, but the point of we're not talking about flames, that's a mushal. It's just a metaphor, We're talking about the nature of the Jewish soul to want to lose its own entity or its own identity and to become subsumed within the oneness. That's its nature. It's sort of counter to self-perpetuation, which is an anomaly within all of reality. Everything is sort of built with an MO to preserve itself, and the Jewish soul just wants to lose itself in Hashem. And then in Chof, we said, okay, how's this information going to be useful to us? Like, how are we going to use this this information to align ourselves emotionally with perfect mitzvah observance? So we said, well, first of all, we're going to do a reduction here. And we're going to say, yes, I said the disclaimer, and I'll say it again. that this is an oversimplification for the purposes, the sole purposes of this tool. Do not infer from this a general worldview. In fact, specifically infer, not infer. Hear me very explicitly saying, this is not the general worldview that we adopt. However, in the context of this tool, chapter 20, we say, one must view all behaviors as binary. Do they connect you to God or do they separate you from God? Are they worship of God or are they worship of idols? Why are we doing that? Why are we trying to reduce everything in such a intense, extreme, black and white way? Because we know you have a trigger that will get triggered if you're threatened with the worship of idols. If we can reduce all prohibitions to idol worship, then we figure maybe you'll get that adrenaline rush going, even in situations that you normally would have discounted as minor infractions. Okay, so then to understand properly how we can really assert that all mitzvahs are either the worship of God or, God forbid, the worship of idols, we started in chapter 1 to talk about that the all of reality is nothing more than speech. And just like speech has no real existence unto itself, so too the worlds have no real existence unto themselves. Then in chapter 21, we said, oh, by the way, you know that metaphor about the world being like Hashem's speech? It's not even a good metaphor, really. Because Hashem is so categorically unique. And really, it's not even like that, but it's even more so. And whatever, it was worth a shot. Okay. It was an approximation. Anyways, you know what that thing? It's like that, but it's not. So that was where we left off with 21. The point of 21, basically, is not to like erase the point of 20. It's more to say, look, ultimately, this is just a metaphor. We're getting as close as we can get, but we're never going to really understand divine oneness. And again, the point of these chapters is not a treatise on divine unity. Divine unity is a side point that's necessary in furthering the argument that one could view all sins as completely a complete radical disconnect, God forbid, from God, as severe as worshiping idols. Okay? So there's either affirming God's unity or denying it. Those are the only two choices. All right. So now we're on chapter, you following this? Okay, we're on chapter 22. Rakshahateta dibra kalashim b'nei adam. We're again apologizing for the limitations of a metaphor. Torah assumes the way of human speech. V'nikra b'teira dibur shel makim baruch hu b'shem dibur mamash. And it refers to Hashem's creative acts as speech. Ki dibur shel adam, just like human speech. Why? The truth is, it is a pretty good metaphor for describing the descent and the drawing down of vitality to the lower realms through many and powerful contractions of the energy, various different kinds of contractions, which ultimately yield all diverse different creations, all the different varieties. Now, these concealments were so powerful, compressions of godly revelation were so powerful. Until it could actually yield impure things and what we call klipa. Remember we learned about klipa before? And sitra achra. Remember these terms? Klipa and sitra achra. Klipa means the husk. Sitra achra means the other side. We're talking about evil. That the concealment of God's light is so severe that not only Hashem can create otherness, which that itself is a feat, or not real otherness, but the appearance of otherness, Hashem can create the phenomenon, at least from our perspective, that there is something other than Him, there's creation, but even more so, Hashem can actually create the phenomenon of what we call evil, which is a real trick, because now he's creating something that appears to oppose him.
Why would he
do that? I don't know. And that is not the subject here. Why do bad things happen to good people? And I told you last week after the class when no one was around, now you're going to get outed. What chapter are we going to talk about bad things happen to good people?
Not too far.
Guess. Say a number. I bet you get it right.
27.
20? Why? What'd you say?
I said 27.
26. Pretty good. You should go to Atlantic City with that. Okay? You make more money at roulette. What? Nothing out of Hashem, right.
Okay, so here it's talking about something that's lower. Lower than what? Something that's going down. Down from what?
Lower, right. You're questioning this whole manner of mapping higher and lower. Like, if it's all Hashem, what's higher and what's lower? So, obviously, it's not spatial, right? What?
Is that the Tzimtzumim?
Well, we are talking about Tzimtzumim, yeah. Okay, so here's the deal. What if I would tell you, I'm pretty impressed you guys are dealing with such a high-level class. And what if someone would say, I don't know, I thought it was street level. In fact, last week you used to go upstairs at Chabad. This week you walked right in from Central Avenue. Maybe the class went down.
That's very good.
Is that good? Yeah, you like that? I got that from the Rambam. Rambam says that higher angels don't mean that they're standing. They're higher, like, because there's no space. But rather, they have a greater understanding of Hashem. So what we're talking about, higher and lower, we're talking about degrees of revelation and concealment. So the less concealed is the higher. The more concealed is the lower.
Is that something that...
And the lowest concealment is that God would create something that appears to oppose him. Go ahead.
Right. And is that our doing or his doing? Do we create that we're at a lower level of concealment?
So you're asking a question which is not the topic, but I will answer you. Clearly Hashem is the one who created physicality, who took our souls and embodied them, and all of the concealment that entails. However, clearly, through our moral choices, we can exacerbate that situation. But that's not the point here. It's not the point here.
What's
okay.
No concealment?
Just the essence of God as it was prior to any contraction. That's no concealment. And that's where your soul wants to be. Your soul doesn't even want to be in heaven, because heaven is already a degree of concealment, because it's already a form. It's a level. It wants to go pre-level. Your soul wants to go before there's any levels. Even Gan Eden is a concealment.
Angels are on different levels.
Everything's on different levels. Levels means a level of concealment.
So an angel could be shorter than another angel, height-wise, but have greater understanding of Hashem and be at a higher level?
Spiritually shorter, yeah. Not physically, yeah. Yeah. It's like saying a heavy idea. Well, how much does it weigh? Okay, anyway, so Hashem creates, with these tzimtzumim, he goes as far as to create that which appears to oppose him. And they receive their life force from him. Where else do they get it from? You think there's a separate source of life for evil? That's why they are called other gods. Mipnei shi nikosim v'chayusim eino mibichinis ponim el mibichinis acharayim de gedusha. Acherim, other, is similar to another word in the Holy Tongue, acharayim, back. So these are the back entities. What does it mean they are from the back? Upirish acharayim, from the back. Like somebody who gives something to his enemy begrudgingly. He throws it over his shoulder to him because he doesn't want to face him because he hates him.
How do we attract the evil?
Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
It'll happen.
Okay. Kach lamaile bechines panim hu pnimius haratzon elyon v'chavtza emiti asher chavetz Hashem lashbi achayis l'chol hakarev elav misita d'gdusha. So too, above, you're talking about spatial metaphors, forward facing, what does it mean forward facing? When we say Hashem is forward facing, that means, panim means the face, it also is pnimius, which means inwardness. It means when he's giving to whatever he's giving to, he's doing it from an inner will to do so. But impurity and the other side, Hashem hates it, it's an abomination. He doesn't give it from an inner desire. It's like somebody tosses something behind his shoulder, over the back, to someone who he hates. He only does it to set them up to be punished. And to, by contrast, reward the righteous who subjugate the evil. So what are we describing? We're describing two levels of will. Does Hashem want there to be evil?
I guess so.
You know what the biggest proof is?
There is.
Yeah, that there is. However, there are degrees of desire. Do you really, really, really want to pay your electric bill? No, but you have to do it, so you do it. What can you do? Do you really want to feed the meter?
But that's for the good.
Oh, we'll get it.
That's for an apparent good.
Well, this is also, he says, for an apparent good, that this creates reward and punishment, which is integral to the system. So it has a purpose. But that's the point. We're not going to get sidetracked into a philosophical discussion about why evil is necessary in Hashem's system. What we're understanding here, what's important to understand, is that nothing's happening without His will. However, there are degrees of will. So there's that which He really wants, and that which, technically, if we could figure out a way to avoid this whole thing, I would rather just skip it. So evil only exists in order to reach something that he really wants. And by the way, it's not even just one, two like that. Sometimes there are multiple steps. So it's not that I want this thing that I'm about to do. I'm not setting the alarm because that's my deepest desire. I'm setting my alarm so I can wake up. But even waking up at a certain time isn't my deepest desire. So I can be on time for work. But even being on time for work is not my deepest desire. So I can get my paycheck. And even my paycheck's not my deepest desire. So I can support my family. And you go on and on and on and on until you get to that thing that you really want. So if you ask, does Hashem want everything that He created? Yes, or He wouldn't create it. But there are degrees to which He wants it. Yeah. He hates it.
It's for the greater good, and we're supposed to see evil as good, just not real good, then why does it say Hashem hates it?
Well, He does hate it. And if He could avoid it, He would love to avoid it. And ultimately, when Mashiach comes and the goal will be finished, the process will have culminated, it will be gone. The evil will be gone because it was never the point all along. It was only there to serve a purpose. Now it served its purpose. It's gone.
So what's the Hebrew word for hate in the
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I have a hard time understanding that someone can do something that will serve a...
Well, this is an opportunity to expand your cognitive vistas that, yes, there is a concept, and it's no paradox whatsoever. We're explaining it pretty clearly, that Hashem can want to create something which he hates. But we do things that we hate all the time.
Right, but we're limited, which is why we
don't see. And so to speak, by choosing the particular project that he has chosen, which he was not forced to choose, he completely chose it on his own, but he did decide that he wants a project called Create a World That Is the Ultimate Concealment. Not only is it physical, but it's physical and potentially immoral. And in that world, I want there to ultimately be more godliness than in the highest heavens. So no one forced him to pick that project, but once he picked that project, there are certain limitations of how that project will actually take place.
He created those limitations.
Yes, he did create those limitations. He's not, you're correct. He's not bound by anything outside of him, God forbid. You're correct. But this is what he chose. He chose the ultimate pleasure, which is the transformation of darkness into light and bitterness into sweet. That's what he chose. To be the ultimate pleasure. So part of that process necessitates the existence of evil. But this is not the place in Tanya for a discussion of what are we supposed to do, how can we live in a world, how can we live happily in a world where there is apparent evil. The point here, remember, is to help us grasp the idea of all mitzvahs either being an affirmation of God's oneness or a denial thereof, God forbid. So he's explaining to us, Hashem created various degrees of concealment. And he went so far as to conceal himself so much that he could even create that which appears antithetical to him or in opposition to him. V'zeh nikra b'chinas acharayim d'rotzen ha'elyon baruch hu. That is called the back of Hashem's will. That's called the back. Again, metaphorically, like a person who, I'll give it to you, but I'm not even going to look you in the eye. Because I hate you, and I'll throw it over my shoulder. There, take it. I hope you choke on it. Okay. Now, really, Hashem's innermost will is the real vitality that enlivens all of the worlds. The bad guys do not have access to that real energy. Even the back stuff that they get, it doesn't invest itself in them, meaning it's not a match, it's not a fit, it's not compatible energy. They get it in a, it's called makif. Even the acharayim, even the back door black market stuff that they get, even when they get it, they can't internalize it, so to speak, because it's holy and they're unholy. It's not compatible with them. So what do they do? And again, these are spatial metaphors. Please, please think abstractly here. But we're using a spatial metaphor of, rather than taking the energy in, they sort of just allow themselves to like bathe in the energy. And that's how they get enough vitality to live. It's like a Frankenstein's monster. It's not really alive. It's being enlivened.
It would be easier to live like that and not take it all in.
We're talking about the evil stuff itself. It's not alive. It's being enlivened. In fact, because of its evil, it's incompatible with life. It's all Frankenstein's monster. The evil is all Frankenstein's monster. It's not alive. Only holiness is life and therefore living. But it's being enlivened. And even the vitality that it's getting is incompatible with it to the extent that it cannot become one with its vitality. You following what we're saying?
No. My brain hurts right now. But isn't there people on the other side of things also?
What?
Like the robot that can talk and you think it's human and it uses those words, but it's not really a human. It
right.
knows how to simulate humanity because it's programmed into it, but you're not really talking to a human.
But it sounds like what you were saying is so parallel to when we were talking about the relationship between Chassid and the Rebbe. Like from the Acharayim and the...
Oh, wow. Okay, so I'll give you give you credit for that. In chapter 2, very good. In chapter 2, it mentioned that we receive a certain connection with Hashem through our relationship with the tzaddik. And it said even those who rebel against the tzaddik, they're going to still receive the vitality. They'll just receive it from Bechinas Acharayim, from behind the back. Very good. Very good. You're connecting that to that. Yeah. But that's the metaphoric language that Tanya uses, that Chassidus uses, to describe the transmission of vitality to that which ostensibly is undeserving, it's a way of visualizing this perceived contradiction. Like Hashem wants it, then it's not bad. No, it's bad. Oh, so then why would he want it? And the answer is, well, it serves a purpose for now, and as long as it serves a purpose, it's going to be around, but ultimately, when it will have served its entire purpose, it'll be gone. So even now, when it's being enlivened, it's just being propped up. It's not compatible with life itself. It'll never become truly living. And it's being propped up for a very specific agenda. That's all we're saying. Please don't try to grapple with your emotional struggles about the problem of evil in the world, because this is not the place in Tanya that deals with that. As we mentioned earlier, chapter 26 will deal with that. Right now, we're only talking about this to help us visualize divine unity. We're trying to understand what is the opposite? What is the opposite perspective from divine unity? So we're on our way to understanding that. Okay, let's keep trucking. Kachi mokim amisva tumah Hashem yishmereinu. That's why the bad stuff is called the place of death, because it doesn't really have vitality. The evil is leeching, is siphoning from the back, as we said before, energy from holiness. And the energy that it's getting is called exiled. It's exiled. It's not, the holy energy is not at home within this evil stuff. It's being hijacked. It's being hijacked. It's being misappropriated. That's why these negative energies are called other gods or the gods of the backside. And they constitute denial of the oneness of the King of all kings, the Holy One, blessed be He. That's why they have an idolatrous name. Elohim Achedim is an idolatrous name, other gods, which obviously they're not real gods, but that's the name there is to bring out that they are idolatrous. Since the energy that they're getting, the holy energy, what other kind of energy is there? The holy energy that they're getting is in Golus, is exiled within them. So they're not buttled, they're not surrendered to the holiness. Remember, we learned about that in chapter 6, that holiness is surrendered to Hashem. They are not surrendered. They're not surrendered. Va'adarabba, magbia atma kenesher, leimer ani vavsiyei, du kamayimer yo'er li va'ani asisani. To the contrary, not only are they not surrendered, they lift themselves aloft like an eagle, saying, I exist and nothing else. The river is mine and I made myself. That's what Pharaoh said. He said, I made myself. I'm a self-made man. That's why our sages said that arrogance is literally idol worship. Now here's the salient point. The worldview of negativity, we're talking about spiritual negativity, we're talking about the spiritual source of negativity itself, are entities which are completely dependent on God for their existence, like everything is, and yet, and are arrogant enough to think that they are ontologically independent, which is an absurdity. They think they have their own existence when they're siphoning and leeching hijacked energy from Hashem, who is begrudgingly allowing this whole thing to happen for an ulterior motive of his own. And they take that, they misinterpret that. I'm talking about these spiritual entities called Elokim Acherim. They misinterpret that as if they have some type of existence unto themselves, which is an absurdity. And that's why we say arrogance is idolatry. Arrogance is the false notion that I have my own existence. Even if I admit that God is a greater existence than my existence, but the very notion that I have some type of existence unto myself, which is an absurdity, as I have kept saying, that's idol worship.
So how does that work with free will? I mean, if we don't have anything but Hashem, where does the free will come in?
You should be asking the opposite question.
Okay. Ask it.
No, because he's explaining here very well how free will exists. Because of the this intense concealment, obviously it allows for an illusion of independence. He's not saying that it's a complete delusion that somebody would think that they are ontologically independent. He explains very well where that impression comes from. He just says that if you're at all intelligent and intellectually honest, you will realize it's an impossibility. So the illusion we get, just don't be deluded by it. Yeah.
I'm having a hard time reconciling this thing with the evil in the back, because when I think of the back, I think of the spine, which holds up the front and the back. So how can I...
Tell me when you're finished.
Yeah, I'm always finished.
How did that feel? Did that feel like I was paying attention to you?
I'm used to it.
Turning your back on someone. Turning your back on someone. Now I'm looking at you, though. Turning your back on someone is a sign that, short of walking out of the room, I'm giving you the minimal amount of energy that I can give you. Go ahead, keep talking, keep talking. Go ahead, keep talking.
Let's unpack that.
So, there are things Hashem creates, and he's like, here, have some energy, have some energy. That's what he likes. Then there are things he creates, he's like, yeah, take it, take it. Okay, let's not. We're in the middle.
During the evil, at least he doesn't turn his back.
He turns his back on the evil, not on you when you're being subjected to the evil. Look, evil doesn't have life. How can it exist? It has to get its life from somewhere. So it's basically Hashem sets up the situation where he knows these guys have their RV parked in his backyard and they're running wires to his meter and the main line, and they're stealing electricity, and he's letting it happen. And he has to pretend he doesn't see it, because really it's not supposed to be, but it's part of the plan. So he's begrudgingly allowing the whole thing. Okay, V'lochi Nemar, we said, V'lochi Nemar, this is the most important part of the chapter. V'lochi Nemar Rezal, Shegas Zeruch Shkula Ka'eved Azorah Mamash. Arrogance is idol worship. Ki Iker V'sheish Aved Azorah. What is idolatry at its root? Really, Aved Azorah is just the belief that one has existence separate from Hashem. Nifrid Megdushos HaShalmakim. Separate from the oneness, separate from the holiness of Hashem. V'lai Kfir Ba Hashem Lagamri. It doesn't mean atheism. Kedi Isa B'Gamara, the Korelei, Alaka, Delakaya. Like it says in Gemara, that the idol worshippers refer to God as the God of the gods, the head of the pantheon. Idol worship is not atheism. In truth, is atheism is not even atheism, according to our definition, because theism, at least the very liberal definition of theism for the purposes of our argument here, is the belief that anything has existence. So, if you believe that anything other than Hashem is ontologically independent, has some existence for itself, even if you concede that Hashem is the source of all other existences and is great, and whose existence is greater than all other existences, that is called idol worship. Idol worship doesn't mean the denial that God exists. It simply means the denial that God is the only existence. And that's why arrogance is idolatrous, because arrogance is the belief in one's own existence, which is not true. I don't have my own existence. I am, and everything else is an extension of Hashem's one true existence. How are we doing with this conceptually? Okay? Yeah? Arrogance here does not mean being a hotshot. Okay. Arrogance means that you think that you exist in some type of autonomous way. So even if you say, I'm a loser, no one likes me, I'm never good at anything, but I do exist and I'm not dependent on another force for my continued existence, that's called arrogance.
So it's like saying, you know, someone's at work and it says, someone that mentions Hashem and he says, this is work, has nothing to do with Hashem, right? Something like that.
Or he says what?
You know, sometimes, I remember having a conversation with someone about politics and I mentioned Hashem in my conversation.
Mm-hmm.
He said, this has nothing to do with Hashem, this is politics.
Oh, this has nothing to do with Hashem, this is politics. Right. Yeah, because to say anything has nothing to do with Hashem. Oh, really? Has nothing to do with Hashem? Then how does it exist? Now, most people today are materialists, so that's not a question they can even handle. It would take probably an hour for you to explain why that's even a question, because the prevalent worldview today is materialism, which is that all reality can be reduced to matter. So they'll just tell you it's just there. And they won't understand the philosophical absurdity of that. They'll say it's just there. Okay.
So what is it in truth? What is the opposite of arrogance? What is the truth?
What is the truth? Okay. We're going to get to that, but when someone asks for the truth, I don't want to push them off. The truth is Ened Milvade. There's nothing but him. That even when you perceive otherness, meaning creation in addition to creator, or even aspects of creation which appear antithetical or even oppositional to the will of the creator, what we refer to as evil, you must realize that that is an illusion, that really there's only one existence. Now, we're not, God forbid, implying moral ambiguity that it's all good. No, we said he hates it. We said it's evil that he hates. But even the evil that he hates is ontologically dependent upon him. It doesn't have its own existence.
So things that don't have their own existence, like even us.
Nothing has its own existence.
Right, so are we created an extension of God, or are we God?
It's an interesting question how to phrase it. Do you say we're all an extension? We and everything else are extensions of God. You say we and everything else are God. Well, you know, it's always tricky when you get into these simplifications. You don't want to oversimplify. And of course, there's this concept of tzimtzum, which we've been speaking about.
The image of God form on this
continuum. Okay. So, remember the point, though. I like to keep everyone focused on the point. The point here is not a deep treatise about the nature of divine unity. That's not the point here. The point is to get us to a clear place of approaching divine morality or the Torah morality as either the affirmation, all mitzvahs either being the affirmation of God's oneness or the denial thereof. So what we've just said, or what we're setting up the assertion for, is that belief that you have independent existence is itself denial of God's oneness. Don't say, oh, no, I believe that God exists. Of course God exists, and he's a greater existence than all of ours, and he's a categorically different existence than all of ours, but I also have an existence. That is idolatry, because in our worldview, idolatry isn't just the belief that there are other gods like that can rival God or even gods that are, or even gods, even deities. Our threshold for idolatry is very, very low. Once you assert that any entity has some type of ontological independence, that itself is antithetical to the true oneness or everythingness of God. How can he be all existence and the only existence while you're attributing existence to something else? Okay, let's finish off the chapter here. El shagam heim machshivim atzmei leyesh v'dav b'fnei atzmei. These idolatrous entities, they see themselves as existing. Uvezem mafridim es atzmei mekdushas shel makim baruchu machshe ein betelim leyes baruch. When they perceive themselves as separate from his holiness, that's how that's what makes them idolatrous, and they perceive themselves as separate because they're not surrendered. They're not surrendered to him. Ki ein kedusha el yenishera el amasha botel leyisbarach kinizkel el. As we mentioned earlier in chapter 6, holiness only rests on that which is surrendered to it. V'lochi nikroim ture de pruda b'zayar kodesh. That's why in the Zohar, it refers to negative spiritual energies or these idolatrous entities, it refers to them as Ture de Pruda, that's Aramaic. Zohar is in Aramaic. Ture is plural, mountains. Pruda means separation, mountains of separation, peaks of separation. Imagine you go out and you look at a plain. It's just flat land. It's almost, it looks like the sea. I heard when Lewis and Clark got to the other side of the Mississippi and they saw the Great Plains, they said it's like an ocean made out of grass. So I don't know if any of us have ever seen untainted nature like that. Have you ever been standing in the middle of a plain where there's no obstruction as far as the eye can see, no man-made structures? You just look. You ever seen this? What?
In the desert?
The desert, you can get that. Yeah, yeah, you can get a similar thing in the desert. If it's a flat desert, yeah, it's just flat, uniform, homogeny. So mountains represent like these breaks in the topography. Boom, there's a peak, and there's a peak. And they have like separate identities. They have names. Each summit has its own name, right? This mountain and that mountain. So negativity is called Ture de Pruda. They're these mountain peaks that poke up. In other words, they give this illusion of a disruption in the unity. And you know what he says? This is denial of Hashem's true oneness. Because the truth is everything before him is insignificant. Everything is truly nullified before him and his will. His will, which is that which enlivens and gives existence to all of them on a constant basis. So what we've done here is we've established a very low threshold for idolatrous belief. What we've said is idolatry doesn't even have to be serving idols. It doesn't even have to be classical idols in the real, you know, polytheistic pagan sense. Idolatry can merely mean a worldview in which there are existences other than Hashem. And if you really want to go where I didn't want to go before about, you know, the problem of evil and, you know, the devil made me do it and all that kind of stuff, if you say that evil exists separately from God, precisely because it's so evil, I don't want it to be part of God's system. So I sort of brand it as being its own thing, its own entity, its own reality. Well, what do you say?
That is the Avodah Zarah.
That is Avodah Zarah.
It paints such a bleak picture of reality, of what is.
Wasn't it supposed to be like that originally?
What was supposed to be?
That evil was supposed to be separate?
Separate and identifiable, not mixed in. Yeah, and the sin of the tree of knowledge got it all mixed together. So you broke the yoke. I wanted a sunny side up, and you made it scrambled. You ever seen a toddler cry when you turn sunny side up into scrambled? That's what happened. Now go put it back.
Rabbi, I'm fixated on free will.
Why are you fixated on free will? It's not about free will. Don't worry about free will. No, because that's not the point here. Wrap your head around one concept. This is all that matters in this chapter. We have set forth a very radical definition of idol worship. We all know that idol worship is a sin. In fact, we know it's a big sin. In fact, we probably all know it's the biggest sin. But we assumed that idol worship looked one way, and now we're finding out that it looks another way, and that certain suppositions about the nature of reality that are easy to slip into, that those are idolatrous. Now, why are we concerned with this right now? Again, I want to remind you the point. Because we need to get ourselves to recoil from moral dilemmas that right now we're not recoiling from. But once we identify what the stakes are, this isn't a little sin. This is idolatry, mamish. This is literal idol worship. Once we identify any break from God's will, any diversion from God's will as literal idol worship, oh, what's going to happen? We're wired for this. We're going to have an intense reaction. Oh, no, get me away from the idol worship. So again, this is not the regular way we go about our lives, looking at every deviation from the exact letter of the law as literal idol worship. But for the purposes of this tool, it's quite effective in triggering an intense reaction, which is what we're trying to do here. Yeah?
The fact that the evil does not have godly light inside of it, so we do, is that what allows us to overcome it?
Okay, you're getting to another question. And it's very interesting to me that in this generation, people are really interested in the emotional implications of this discussion. Like, okay, what do we do now? How do we deal with this evil? And it's interesting because, and I keep on, it's very tempting, by the way, to go into this discussion because I see how earnestly everyone's asking it, and I see that it's something that everyone really wants to talk about and needs to talk about, and I'm not allowing the conversation to go there because, two reasons. One is I want you to have the satisfaction of getting through chapters 18 through 25 properly. So I want you to have that accomplishment. But also, we are going to deal with this question. We are going in the appropriate place. But right now, the Alter Rebbe is not expecting you to have an emotional reaction to this subject matter. He's just expecting you to absorb it on a philosophical level, so that you can reframe the way that you view moral dilemmas. Okay? All righty.